For a preacher, this is an exceptionally rich passage. There are so many different things I could do with the text from Luke that Ron just read for us. I could take you into the world of ancient church controversy and bore you to tears with a discussion of Doceticism, a tendency amongst some in the early church to claim that Jesus did not actually physically suffer, that he only appeared to be in pain, that at the time of the crucifixion, a miracle took place, and somehow Jesus was replaced by Judas or Simon of Cyrene. It's not that often I get a passage where I could spend time looking at abstruse theological controversies and indulge Dan Brown-like conspiracy theory. Not going to do that today. I could also spend some time talking with you about ghosts. Now, maybe that's a little more interesting, or pique your curiosity, but it's very clear in this passage, Luke doesn't want people to think that Jesus was a ghost. Now, in 21st century America, we tend to be pretty skeptical about ghosts, but back in first century Judea, and indeed throughout the ancient world, people believed in ghosts. They thought they were part of the landscape. They were part of normal life. Luke did not want people to think Jesus was a ghost. He wanted them to understand something different happened at the moment of resurrection. So I'm not going to spend too much time talking about ghosts, although I will offer this morsel for reflection. While I am not going to posit a belief in ghosts, I do consider the fact that we learn every day through modern scientific inquiry and discussion that reality is a lot weirder and stranger than we can ever imagine. And we are, as a faith, a group of people who claim that God came to us in the form of a baby, lived as a person, was executed, and then rose from the dead. Strange but true, we argue. I could talk about the faith journey of the disciples that is delineated in this passage. We see them going from fear to curiosity and to hope. But the thing that I keep coming back to is this whole question of resurrection. And as I contemplate resurrection, I do so today needing to make a confession to you. And that is that my heart is not in preaching to you this morning. I've been doing this now in one form or another since 2003. And I enjoy the work of preaching. I enjoy spending time with the texts and reflecting on what God might be trying to say to me, what word the Spirit wants me to share with you. My reluctance hasn't anything to do with the business of preaching or with the notion of resurrection, but with where I am today. Yesterday, I received a phone call. Bear with me. One of my oldest and dearest friends had died. Somebody I've known since 1982. Someone who magically, and I hope that you've all experienced this, was one of those friends who became part of the family. Someone who's in my wedding. Someone who's been like an adopted uncle or grandfather to Chip. Someone who felt comfortable enough around Rachel to tell her at a critical moment in our relationship that she'd better be okay with my book problem because that's who I was. I knew this was coming. Indeed, we as a congregation have prayed for Stan and his wife, Kathy, over the last months. But for those of us who have ever experienced the loss of somebody dear to us, we know that there is a difference between knowing something in our heads, preparing ourselves for an eventuality, and then living with that reality. This morning, about the first thought I had after waking up was, Stan is still dead. I dreamt about this last night. Stan is still dead. So what am I to do with this during this Eastertide when the church proclaims new life? What am I supposed to do with this as a preacher who over the years has stood in a pulpit and said time and again that the message of the resurrection is that the light has displaced the darkness, hope triumphs over despair, and that life conquers death? I know that none of you are interested in cheap theological explanations or ecclesiastical arguments. I know I'm not. I want to know what this means for me in lived life. What does it mean? So I thought about today's story, about this appearance of Jesus to the disciples. It's a third such incident that Luke reports. The first was to Mary, the second to the travelers on the road to Emmaus, and the third is to the gathered disciples. There's a pattern here. You can see it. The circles of Revelation are expanding. They're getting larger. But what happens when Jesus stops appearing to people? The story doesn't grind to a halt, does it? People continue to tell it. They continue to witness. Did you hear that at the end of the reading, that word witness? Now that can be a church buzzword, witness. Isn't that what people wearing sandwich boards who stand on corners do? The people who leave leaflets under the windshield wiper of our car or in our mailboxes? Isn't that what evangelicals do? We don't do that. We don't tell the story. We don't want to offend anybody. Don't want to get in anybody's face. But someone told you the story, and someone told me the story. Somehow that story came to life for us. Otherwise, we would not be here in this sanctuary this morning. Newsflash, it's sunny and warm outside. We could be bicycling or hiking or cleaning up the yard. We could be doing something else, but we are here. As are millions and millions of Christians around the world. Because somebody witnessed. Somebody witnessed to an event that they personally did not see. I can't attest to the historicity of the resurrection. There's no YouTube video, no archaeological stuff that I can put in front of you. What I can do is tell a story. A story that has changed a life. So I want to give you an example of what witnessing can be. I'm going to tell you a little bit about this man, Stanley Remsburg, that none of you have ever met, with the exception of Rachel. Stan, as I mentioned before, loved books. He loved reading. If you think I've got a lot of books, you ain't seen nothing till you see the number of books Stanley had. Stanley's love of reading and books was a reflection of his love of history. Stan had a PhD, and he taught for a number of years, and then was in administration, and then he went to work for a historical society. Stan had a great gift that I also hope everybody here has experienced at one time or another with a teacher, and that is ability to tell stories that make them come alive. Stan's area of expertise was 19th century American history with an emphasis on the Gilded Age. And I remember when we went to Newport and visited some of the cottages, and we were taking a tour of the breakers, and he would offer a comment here and a side there, and it became very clear to the docent, who was really well trained, that Stanley knew more than she could ever hope to know. And she handed the tour over to him. And he had people in his hand. Before, though, we think that Stan was some kind of perfect pedagogical icon, I should tell you that he was also the very model of the absent-minded professor. I remember him telling me the story of the time that he had taken a thesis that he was working on with one of his students, and he drove home from the college to his house, and along the way he noticed pieces of paper, and he stopped the car and he realized that he put the thesis on top of the car as he was unlocking the door. When he got in, he didn't take the paper inside with him, so he had to go and drive back. And he found every single piece of paper because he knew how much effort and work his student had put into it. And this was in the days before you could just say, please print out another copy from the computer. Stan would tell me stories of his hometown of El Dorado, Kansas. He grew up there in the 1940s and 50s. And he told me these stories not as one who was living in the past, but one who could delight in it. And so I came to know some of the characters there and some of the rhythms of this place. I've never been to Kansas, and I doubt I will ever go there. But I felt I came to know El Dorado. And then there's the figure of Lash LaRue. Now, some of you here may be familiar with this minor figure in American pop culture. Stan grew up in a day and an age when lots of little boys, and I suspect girls too, loved Westerns. And of course, the big figure in the world of Westerns was the Lone Ranger. But Stan, God bless him, didn't follow the pack and give his affection to the Lone Ranger, who everybody could root for. But instead, he loved Lash LaRue. When he first told me about Lash LaRue, I didn't believe him. He's a character who would hide behind a rock and then jump out to surprise the bad guys. And he didn't use a gun, he used a whip, a bullwhip. Get real. Thanks to the internet, I learned that Lash LaRue was indeed real. And indeed, I'm telling Chip about Lash LaRue last night. We looked him up online and discovered that it was Lash LaRue, a real figure, who taught Harrison Ford how to use the bullwhip for Raiders of the Lost Ark. And their story from the past came alive in the present. Someone that my son has known over the years is gone, but he is still present in his life. And he is in mine. This is witnessing. It's not that hard, is it? We all do it in some way or form, talking about loved ones, whether they be family or friends. And hopefully we do it in a way that brings them alive. This is what Jesus was inviting the disciples to do and has invited you and me to do, is to tell stories. And we tell the story of a resurrection, of new life. And that's a phrase that can be so empty. But I reflected just on this past week and what new life has meant and the things I've done, the people I've met. I have a professional colleague who had appeared to reach a cul-de-sac. And it looked like she needed to maybe consider doing something different with her life. When I heard about this, I talked with her, and I realized that I might have some ideas that I could share with her. And so I was able to connect her with another colleague. Was able to offer a concrete element of hope and build a connection there, which looks like it may bear fruit. I think about a clergy colleague who called me up from the airport the other day. And he's leaving the country. And he has a church in another part of the state, and had just found out that one of his church members was going to be at DHMC. A 6-year-old boy named Calvin, whom we will pray for later on. And Calvin has pneumonia, and my colleague David asked me if I might be able to visit. And I said, of course I'll do that. And so I had the opportunity to spend time with Calvin and his dad yesterday. And I know that in being there, I was able to represent something. I have no special gift or talent this way. But walking in the door, I was able to show what it means to say we're the church, that we're present. A moment of discomfort and pain. Particularly acute for me as I was there yesterday, looking at a 6-year-old boy. I've got an 8-year-old. I can relate to that a little too closely. I was able to feel God's presence and God's love in the moment. And then I think about this journey that I've taken with Stan and his wife Kathy over these last few weeks and months. How I've been able to not only be present there for Stan, but also restore and renew and refresh my relationship with Kathy. And I got to know Kathy's sister, Martha, who's been a tremendous help to the family through all this, and got to meet some of Stan's friends who I'd heard about over the years. And we were able to support one another and build connections and create some ties that didn't exist before. These are simple, small things, but this is the new life that we talk about in the gospel. When we hear the word resurrection and people coming back to life, I think there's a temptation to imagine that the dead are going to be alive again. And we think of stories like Lazarus or Jairus' daughter. They're dead and they're brought back. But that's not what resurrection is. Those stories involve rewinding the proverbial tape, going back. But what Luke tells us here is that when Jesus came back, and make no doubt about it, Jesus was back, physically present with the disciples, it was in a different way. Resurrection is about going forward, but doing so differently. At a minimum, resurrection involves being able to live our lives in a way that is fed by the Spirit and by God's hope and God's grace and God's power and God's love. That's a story worth telling. That's a vision of resurrection that doesn't talk about displacing the reality we have, but gives us a way to move forward in that reality. To go forward in a way that can make real for us the claim that in Easter, God has indeed allowed the light to triumph over the darkness, to hope to prevail over despair, and for, yes, life to triumph over death.